You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. An NPR story about billionaire Mark Benioff buying land in and around Waimea on Hawaii Island caused quite a stir when it was published this past February. It was titled, A Tech Billionaire is Quietly Buying Up Land in Hawaii. No one knows why. It was written by tech reporter Derek Kerr. In the days after, many internet articles and social media posts echoed suspicions about Benioff's ulterior motives. Kerr also published an audio version of her article this past March. If you haven't heard it, here's a clip.
The big question around town is, what is this billionaire up to? Everyone knows it's Mark Benioff. He's the co-founder and CEO of Salesforce, one of the world's largest software companies. The mystery here is, how much land has he bought and what is he going to do with it? Waimea resident Mike Donahoe says without information, people fill in the blanks.
I mean, that's kind of how the rumor mill starts, right? You know, the people that have been there for quite a while, they get a little nervous about that.
Waimea is not the sun-soaked town you envision when you think of Hawaii. It's up in the mountains and is known for its chilly rain and cattle ranching. It has just three stoplights and, as Lam and I find, feral pigs.
God, those pigs! There's a lot of them!
Yeah, there's like 10.
Plenty of tech billionaires have bought up land in Hawaii, mostly coastal mansions and gated communities. Benioff himself built a beachside mansion on the Big Island 20 years ago. When I meet him later, he says he's always loved Hawaii.
It's a magical place. It's a place that people come and transform and change, evolve. They experience God. They experience nature. They experience themselves.
The Conversation's Russell Subiono grew up in Waimea and has deep ties to the land and community there. Several friends and relatives reached out to him after Kerr's article was published to share their thoughts. He recently had the opportunity to talk to her about it.
I've read that you're originally from Colorado. You're based in the Bay Area. I know you're a tech reporter for NPR. What got you interested in covering this story about Mark Benioff buying land on a small island in the middle of the Pacific?
Well, my family has lived off and on Hawaii for several generations. So I spent a lot of time growing up there. I lived there as a kid. I went to Waimea Elementary School for just a year in fourth grade, but it was formative. And I go back as often as possible. And my family lives there off and on, part-time and full-time. And yeah, so I was there visiting my family in November. And I started just hearing these rumors around town. And as the tech reporter at NPR, I was interested because everyone knew it was Mark Benioff. But no one knew what was going on. And people seemed pretty freaked out. You know, not everybody, but a lot of people are like, is he going to bring in all these engineers? And like, is that going to change the face of our town? And so I just got really curious to figure out what was going on.
Anybody that has really studied Hawaii's history knows that it has a checkered past with large landowners. Larry Ellison and the others before him that owned 98% of Lanai, that always comes first to mind. And then after the state and federal governments, Kamehameha Schools is the state's largest landowner. And then it's Parker Ranch, also there in Waimea. Also on that list, Alexander and Baldwin and Molokai Ranch, two companies that many locals take issue with. Based on that history, do you feel or do you find that locals are justified in expressing concern when another billionaire starts buying large tracts of land in Hawaii?
Yeah, I mean, I can 100% see the fear. There's a long hundreds years history of land being taken from local people and local people being pushed into, you know, certain locations that aren't as nice. And with Mark Benioff, he doesn't own a ton of land compared to those people on the list, even compared to Mark Zuckerberg and Kauai. But what was really compelling to me about what was happening in Waimea was that he was buying in Waimea. A lot of these other billionaires, the new like group of billionaires that have been buying land, they buy down by the beach. They buy ranches like Oprah, where they're not around people. Or like Zuckerberg, you know, there's people around, but he basically has a walled compound that's all for himself. So what was interesting about Benioff is that he's buying a ton of parcels in this residential town there's like neighbors everywhere. I mean, it was really interesting. And I could see how that would worry local people on a whole bunch of fronts. Like, what's going to happen? And are costs going to go up? And, you know, what's he planning to do? So, yeah.
Your February article is titled, "A Tech Billionaire is Quietly Buying Up Land in Hawaii. No One Knows Why." And your March audio piece has a very similar title. You did get the chance to talk to Benioff. Did he share with you why?
Not really. You know, it seems that what he's mostly doing is this is just personal property. Although, like, how exactly it's being used as personal property isn't clear. And now, like, rumors are swelling again around town. But yeah, it was really hard to get an answer about, like, why and what. He was adamant that he's not doing anything with Salesforce there. He wasn't moving in employees. There was nothing to do with his business. It was personal. And in the story, I talk a lot about how he talked to me a lot about his philanthropy on the islands. So oftentimes when I'd ask him, like, why Maya? Like, why? He would divert the conversation to his philanthropy. So it's quite difficult to get an answer.
Kind of seems like he didn't really help kind of set the record straight for anybody.
Yeah. I mean, there is like the huge plot of land that he did donate. Part is donated and part is to be donated. So he says, which I, you know, totally believe because it's in a nonprofit. And that is going to be for affordable housing. To me, it was helpful in some of dispelling some of the like fear and that he's not going to build a Salesforce facility. Because that could really change the character of the town.
For our podcast, This Is Our Hawaii, we did a two-parter on Lanai, 98% of which is privately owned by billionaire Larry Ellison. We did try to get in contact with Larry Ellison, as well as the leadership of Pulama Lanai, the management company, but they were pretty much largely disinterested in talking with us. One of the most impressive things about your piece is that you had more than one conversation with Benioff, right? What was that like?
Yeah, well, frankly, I wasn't expecting that. He is known to be very friendly with the press and open with the press. But, you know, I've covered tech companies for a long time and the experience you had with Larry Ellison surprises me none. It's very hard to get tech leaders and high-ups executives at tech companies to talk to you as a reporter. He reached out to me first via my colleague. So I was just kind of poking around town, asking questions, trying to map out the property records. And he got in contact with one of my colleagues and said he wanted to speak with me. And so, yeah. And so then we started this months-long conversation. We spoke on the phone a couple of times. We texted a lot. But I would say the vast majority of those conversations were about his philanthropy. It seemed that's how he really wanted the story to be focused. And then I did have a sit-down interview with him in Waimea at one of his properties.
While we were doing our interviews and doing our research on Lanai and talking to a lot of the residents there, many of them brought up that Larry Ellison, who has so much influence on their community, isn't accessible to them. Do the residents that you talk to in Waimea, do they feel like they have access to Benioff, that he's part of the community?
No. No. I mean, there's definitely a handful of people I spoke with who do have access to him and who he speaks to, leaders of the town and leaders of the community. But the vast majority of people said it's near impossible to understand what he's doing and what's going on. It's very similar to what you said happened with Larry Ellison. Like, there's no clear plans about his intentions to the larger community. And I think that's why people started getting really worried. And to backtrack a teeny bit too, like, the timing of this is interesting because the vast majority of Benioff's land buys in Waimea have been since the pandemic. So it's new. And so I think when I talked to him, he kept asking, why are you doing the story? Why are you doing the story? I'm like, because you just bought all this land and people are freaking out. And so, yeah, but that is definitely something I've heard from people. And since the story published, I've gotten just a ton of emails from people, and it's been really interesting. And that is like the through line that I have heard, is that people just are worried because there's this lack of communication.
When you look at what just happened on Maui and the fears of land developers coming in and buying out people who live there, or the government claiming eminent domain over everything, all of these fears are very real.
One of the stats that I got from the county that I didn't put in my story, but I found really shocking, was on the Big Island, 19% of the housing there is vacant, which means second homes. It's a real problem.
When you did talk to Benioff, or when you did look at some of these land transactions, did you get a sense of who was selling land to Benioff? Was it other major landowners or ranchers, or was it private citizens? Did you get a sense of who owned the land before he did?
Yeah, I got some of a sense. In the property records, you can't see that. So what I learned was basically from just what people told me. So it's not fully substantiated, but for the most part, it seems like it's individual owners, citizens, that are selling their property. What I tracked, when I tracked all the numbers, the vast majority of these purchases were done over the current market value. So, you know, I think there's probably people that, you know, I don't know if these are all cash buys, but I wouldn't be surprised. And so it's just like, it's an easy transaction. You can't fault the local people for wanting to make the most on their property. But yeah, that was the main thing that I heard.
That was NPR reporter Adara Kerr talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about an article that she wrote back in February. It looked at why billionaire Mark Benioff was buying land on the Big Island. We'll continue with that interview right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theatre, reimagining homelands with Kenny Endo, Norman Kaneshiro, and Yuki Shiroma, retells ancestral memories April 20th and 21st. leeward.hawaii.edu/leewardtheatre.
Let's return to our conversation between NPR reporter Adara Kerr and the conversation's Russell Subiono. They've been talking about a story that Kerr wrote about how billionaire Mark Benioff was buying land on the island of Hawaii.
I know there are many wealthy people from the U.S. and internationally that own property on the Big Island. Do you think it might have been the scale at which Benioff was buying land and donating money that raised some eyebrows? If he had donated, say, 80 acres to an affordable housing nonprofit instead of 280, or donated $15 million instead of $150 million to Hilo Medical Center, do you think that you would have still pursued this story?
Well, all of that information came out because of my reporting. I think he was already in the process of doing those donations. I don't know. He may have stayed anonymous. But when I started digging around is when he said he would no longer be anonymous. So I didn't know that he was going to donate that land by the time I spoke with him. And after I had spoke with him was when he published the press release on the land donation. So yeah. I had already asked him about a lot of those land buys. I mean, he is a huge philanthropist. There's a whole debate you could have about philanthropy, but he's very generous. Affordable housing doesn't seem to be one of his major topics, but it's not outside the purview of things he donates to. I mean, his name is everywhere in the Bay Area. And I met with the executive director of the nonprofit that is doing the affordable housing project. And the timeline squares. Benioff got in touch with him way before my story.
In your pieces about Benioff, you do touch on the idea that he bought much of his land through anonymous companies known as LLCs. You even reached out to a University of Alabama law professor who shared some ideas or some reasons why people would do it that way. When we were doing research for This Is Our Hawaii, we also came across a lot of reasons why people would buy property through an LLC. It was something that we had to kind of learn about and talk to different experts about to really understand why the law professor that you talk to seems to believe that people do it so that they don't want to be outed or they're hiding behind the LLC. In some of our research, we found that it is a very common practice for a variety of reasons, including liability protection and tax benefits. When you talked to Benioff, did he share why he chose to buy the land through the LLCs?
Yeah, he said that it was for the privacy of his family. He was very adamant about the security and privacy of his family. So if there are other reasons, I don't know him.
Kind of overall, in your interaction with him, whether it was in person or I imagine you guys exchanged phone calls and texts and emails maybe, overall, did you get the sense that he was telling you the truth? Did you get a sense that he was telling the whole truth? Or do you think that maybe he was withholding something or maybe trying to just put his best looking side forward?
I have no reason to believe he was withholding something. Speaking with him was not necessarily straightforward because he had an agenda that he wanted me to pursue, which was his philanthropy. And so everything always turns back to that. So it was really hard actually to get straight answers because they would be deflected to the philanthropy, which does, you know, can raise suspicions. But I have, you know, for the most part, he was pretty straightforward. When I told him about the land, he, you know, he was like, yeah, I have that piece and that piece. Like, he didn't try and deny anything, but it was an interesting situation.
You know, when your written article first came out in February, I saw it start to pop up all over my newsfeed and social media. And then I came across a handful of articles that other media companies and other internet publications either referenced or borrowed from your article, at the very least referenced it. I've also heard from several Waimea residents that shared their thoughts with me. What kind of response have you seen to your pieces?
Well, you know, as a reporter, especially at a publication that's as widespread as NPR, you're used to getting a lot of trolling and a lot of negative feedback. And I must say, for the story, I got nothing, no negative feedback. And I'm really heartened by that. For the most part, people, I've gotten so many thank you notes, and it's so nice to hear that. And people saying that, like, they feel seen, which is, you know, the whole reason we do this job, right, is to, like, bring light to things that are important in people's lives. So the reaction that I've gotten, I haven't read all the social media forums and stuff, has been really good.
Did you hear back from Benioff after your article was published? Did he have feedback for you?
No, it's been radio silence. So, yeah.
As you know, and we've talked about this before, I'm from Waimea as well. I have many family members and friends who live there. And I've seen some of these people share your article and express their suspicion on social media. But the people who have actually reached out to me to talk to me, they all defend Benioff. And they feel that his intentions and his generosity are genuine and he has a real connection with the area. And many of those people feel that the actions that have been misconstrued as deceptive or having an ulterior motive were really about being humble and not wanting to make a big deal. What would you say to people who took that issue with your piece?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to be as fair as possible and include all the philanthropy that he's done. I mean, if you read the piece from a non-cynical view, you could be like, wow, this guy is doing a lot in town and for the islands. I mean, with the newest donation of $150 million to the hospitals, yeah. I don't think that that negates that he came into town and bought a lot of land. You can't just buy a lot of land in town and people don't notice. And I'm not prescribing any judgment on that, but that's what happens. So people can decide for themselves what they think about that. But there's no disputing that he's been incredibly generous and helpful in the community. And there's no disputing that a lot of people in the community really love him and think he has been, you know, a lot of times I heard a quote, like, blessing to the community. So
I feel like the people that had issue with your pieces mostly had issues with your headline. And it felt like it was clickbait or like it was something that was put up there to get people to read it and kind of start off on a negative view of him. What would you say to somebody who shared that reaction with you?
Yeah, well, I'd say, first of all, most reporters don't write their own headlines. but second of all, I actually don't think the headlines were negative or misleading. Like, the main digital one said, a tech billionaire has been quietly buying vast land in Hawaii. Fact. And it has been quiet. It was secret with LLCs. And no one knows why. Fact. I don't see that necessarily as negative or clickbaity. I mean, I guess it's, you know, you do want to know, like, who it is. Like, could be clickbaity, but not, it's not like 7 reasons why cats die. Or whatever. Yeah. I don't know.
Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up or share with our listeners about your piece or about your experience?
You know, the only thing I can really think of is just that Waimea is a really special town. And I think that also was one of the motivations for me wanting to do this story. I care about it. You know, I lived there for just a tiny bit as a kid and visit frequently, but, you know, it's made its impact on me, you know, as a mainlander. And it's interesting to see how places change over time.
Derek Kerr, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been so nice. Thank you for having me on the show.
That was NPR reporter Dara Kerr talking to HPR's Russell Subiono. We'll have a link to Kerr's story on our website after the show. Next week, we'll air interviews with Waimea residents who took issue with Kerr's article and shared a side of Mark Benioff that they felt was left out. We also welcome your thoughts. Call our talkback line. Record something. 808-792-8217 or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Kapulani Landgraf, Aua, a photographic installation about Lahui featuring 108 Kanaka O'iwi, now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
You know, the pandemic threw the world on its end, and many people responded by doing something different. Many switched jobs, though some not by choice. Journalist Joanne Lippman is the author of the book, Next, The Power of Reinvention in Work and in Life in Work. During our chat this morning, I shared that it took an ocular migraine to get me to switch to radio after more than 30 years in TV news. Interestingly, one of the people that Lippman interviewed for her book was Tau Pupua, the NFL player turned opera singer. We featured the Tongan tenor on HPR earlier this year, but here's Lippman talking about her book.
This is really about life changes. How do you best navigate changes in your life, in your career? How do you come back from an injury, from failure, from some sort of trauma? And so I interviewed several hundred people who had been through every kind of transition that you can imagine. And then I interviewed experts. There's actually an emerging science in change and in transition, whether you're talking about neuroscientists who are now examining what happens inside your brain when you have one of those life-changing aha moments, or whether you're talking about psychologists who have a new understanding of trauma survivors and how they can move on. And so I spoke to these experts as well. And what was so fascinating is after I did all of, like, several hundred interviews, I sat down and kind of mapped out literally by hand, pencil and paper, the stages, the process that they all walked me through. And I realized I was floored because they used different words, but pretty much everybody was describing the same set of steps. It was basically boiled down to 4 steps. So what I do with the book is talk about what are these steps and how do we get through them better?
Well, I've always heard try something new and you build new brain cells,
yeah,
right? You get re-energized. I imagine that's all part of that process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What's really interesting is, you know, we have in our culture this sort of idea that transformation of any sort is supposed to happen like overnight. I call it the Cinderella myth, this idea that, you know, we hear these stories like, you know, like football player to opera singer, right? Like, boom. But it doesn't happen overnight. You know, we're stuck on this Cinderella idea or American Idol or Superman or Spider-Man. But in fact, what I found is that almost every transition, even ones that seem super extreme, they start very slowly. They start very often unintentionally. So many of the people I interviewed didn't even know that this hobby they had or this kind of side gig they had or this random interest they had would eventually lead them to pivot. And they were just open to the idea of taking another turn.
Yeah, it's opening up that window, getting some fresh air in, maybe, yes. You know, but just knowing that maybe there's something inside that's guiding you, but you don't know it yet.
Yeah, yeah. So it turns out that when people do decide to pivot, almost always they're further along than they realize, because almost unintentionally, they've been collecting information, they've been collecting experiences, they have more knowledge than they realize. The real problem, though, is that when they do decide to pivot, there is this sort of middle period that everybody goes through. I call it the struggle stage. And in fact, it's really uncomfortable. And it's that moment when you're sort of leaving your previous identity behind, but you haven't figured out the new one and you're in limbo. And it feels like you're stuck. And it also feels like only you are struggling. It feels really lonely. And it feels like everybody you know is on this glide path to success. And only you are struggling. But in fact, everybody goes through it. And what I learned in my research is during that period of time is actually the single most productive part of this whole transition when you're moving from one thing to the next. It feels like you're stuck, but you actually are moving forward. You know, I talk about these four steps: search, struggle, stop, solution. The search is what I talked about, unintentionally collecting information. The struggle is what I was just referring to that we all go through. The stop is generally something that pulls you out of your routine. So it could be something like your ocular migraines, or it could be an illness. It could be switching jobs. It could be quitting your job. It could be having a baby. Whatever it is, it pulls you out of your routine. And you kind of need that to get out of your own head. It gives you perspective on sort of where you're going, and it clarifies for you, this is where I need to pivot to. And that's what leads to that fourth step, which is the solution, which is where you are pivoting to.
You know, I think we've come through this pandemic, life-changing, right? Major disruptions, but things are settling down, you know, but maybe people settled back into their jobs, but are dissatisfied.
I do think we had a real change with the pandemic, and that was actually the impetus to start writing the book. We didn't know when we were in it, in the midst of the beginning in particular. You didn't know when was it going to end, what was the world going to look like, and we really had a wholesale, you know, I just talked about that stop. That was a stop for all of us, and we really saw people rethinking their priorities and also rethinking their relationship to their jobs. You know, people rethinking, what do I really value? How do I want to spend my time? And I think that is something that is settling out now, but we really are at a moment between the pandemic and then you look at sort of our climate change and political unrest, and here we had the Maui wildfires. We have all of these stressors, right? And there's a lot of change. There's a lot of flux right now. And I think we are at this inflection point. I don't think in our lifetimes we've had this much sort of uncertainty and change. And that's why so many people right now are thinking about, like, what comes next for me? How do I get there? Right? It is a really pivotal moment right now.
That was the first part of our interview with former Wall Street reporter and author Joanne Lipman. She's here on Oahu to give a talk on the Manoa campus on Wednesday. We will continue our conversation with her right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from the East-West Center Gallery's exhibition, Kabuki in Hawaii, highlighting the Japanese theater form's history in the islands, on view through May 5th, messaging supported by the Turbin Chu Fund.
Let's get back to our interview with journalist and author Joanne Lipman. Do you know that, or did you know that Alan Greenspan, the former chair of the Federal Reserve, switched careers? He loved math, but he started out as a clarinet player in a band. He is just one of the many people that Lippman talked to while researching her new book.
The book is two things. One is it's heavily researched and has tons and tons of stories that you will find one or two or three or more people in that book that you can relate to in the kinds of transitions they went through. But then I distill the lessons from the people I spoke to and from the experts and the scientists I spoke to. And I've got about a dozen strategies in the back of the book, basically a toolkit that tells you if you're in this sort of pivotal moment, what are some things that you can do? And I give some, you know, pieces of advice. One of the most important strategies, I think, for people is this idea that you need to be open to the change, first of all. It's really, really scary to take that first step if you want to make a change. And that prevents a lot of people from starting in the first place. I found that people who were sort of open to the universe, in a sense, open to their gut feelings. I have a whole chapter on gut feelings and why actually it's good to listen to your gut, right? It actually makes sense to listen to your gut. And there's some research behind that. But the people I spoke to were open to these pivots. There was research that was done by Washington University where they talked to people who had these aha moments and literally changed their lives. Like they either got out of a toxic relationship or they switched their career or some other major pivot. And when they interviewed the people, what they all had in common was they said, I decided not to discount this feeling, like push it away, but to listen to it. And that was what led them to their transition. So that was one thing. Another element that I love so much because, you know, this sort of American ethos of sort of the lone, you know, we're the self-made men of this country. Nobody was like that. Honestly, the people who were successful at transitioning, they all had what I call an expert companion. I borrowed this phrase actually from trauma psychologists who work with trauma survivors. The expert companion is somebody who knows you really well, who can reflect back to you what are your strengths, what are your talents. And the reason that's so important is because none of us have a very good perception of ourselves. So you need somebody who knows you well to be able to tell you. We all have talents that are innate. They come so naturally, we either don't recognize them, or if we recognize them, we discount them. We're like, ugh, it's too easy. So you need somebody else to do that. But the expert companion doesn't tell you what to do. They are the person who can just help you see yourself more clearly. And one other I would mention that's really important, if there's anybody who's listening who is actually thinking about, like, what's my first step? Like, what do I do? One of the very, very best pieces of advice is to reach out to what are called weak ties and dormant ties. So weak ties are people you don't know very well. Dormant ties are people who you lost touch with, like, you know, somebody you worked with 5 years ago, let's say. And what's so great about that is we tend to rely on the closest circle around us when we're thinking about these changes. But in fact, the weak ties, the dormant ties, the people beyond your tight circle are the ones who are most likely to surface the best advice and opportunities. And LinkedIn actually studied its own members and found that they tend to get jobs not from their closest ties, but from those weak and dormant ties from that extended network. It's really helpful. And by the way, if you don't know how to do that, one easy way that I love, and I give this advice all the time, is think about somebody who helped you in the past, right? Somebody who you've lost touch with. And just today, you can do this right now, today, just like shoot them a quick email just to say, thinking of you, I just want to thank you for the help you gave me. And I will tell you, this actually happened to me not long ago. A long ago colleague out of the blue sent me a note just to say, you know, I was really struggling. This was 10 years ago. And you probably don't remember this, but you really helped me through. And first of all, it made me cry, the note. I was so touched. But it also inspired me to do the same thing, to reach out to someone else who had helped me. I happened to be a longtime breast cancer survivor. And it prompted me to write a note to my breast cancer surgeon to say, thank you. Like, I'm still here. Like, wow. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. You'll feel great when you do it, but also it's a great way to kind of rekindle these relationships. And also it ends up surfacing sort of opportunities and ideas and opening up your mind to new things.
That was author Joanne Lipman talking about her new book, Next, The Power of Reinvention in Life and Work. She's to give a talk at the University of Hawaii Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. It's part of the Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. We will have links on the conversation page of our website after the show.